Mother Earth has succeeded fairly well in making the body of man. This body as a whole is a reasonably perfect organism and functions well and happily, except when accident or some hereditary disease or his own folly above all spoils its working. But by and large, nature has done her task well where the body is concerned. And in this body, she has built a most marvelous organ, the brain. If not for this organ, all that we know as our mental life, our psychical nature, would have no existence or functioning whatever. But the brain is just the physical organism through which this something other than the material body comes into play and manifests. Now, our mental life and what we commonly call our mind, which corresponding to the derivation of the body from Mother Nature, we may say is derived from Father Mind, hasn't the same happy relationship with its origin. The body is to nature in far greater perfection than our minds, our individual minds, are to all mind, to mind only, to pure mind. I'm treating the term pure mind or mind only as if it were an order of being quite other than the entire natural universe. Quite other than, but not unrelated. What the relationship is, I don't know. Somehow, the energy which is pure mind is something which we can't tackle yet. We can't bend it to our will as we can bend all the energies of nature to our will. And what we call our minds are not anywhere near a happy relationship, not anywhere near an efficient, awakened relationship with pure mind. Now this is where we as individuals come into the story. Nature, I believe, cannot do it. Nature has done what she could. And in producing this creature, man, with a brain which stores up experience and knowledge, and this person, the man, has developed the power of speech in addition for communication and for an internal process of discovery. This man has the power to look within himself and to discover the whole of himself, which means exploring this realm which we name pure mind, mind only. Exploring that, not by any means that we have under our control, as far as exploration in the natural universe is concerned, but by means which have still to be discovered. they have been partly discovered. And one of the phrases we use for those means is looking within. This process of looking within, if it is not to be mere introspection, is a process in which the ordinary activity of the brain, the talking mind, comes to an end. When the activity of the talking mind comes to an end, the intrusive activity, I should say, of all the other sense functions and the sense consciousnesses, visual, auditory, tactile, etc., they all meet their Sabbath, their rest, their peace, they are pacified. In that state of Sabbath, one can enter the holy realm, the pure realm of pure mind. And this is the real meaning in the religious context and in the religious sense of looking within. Now, there are some in our human race throughout the ages. They live today too, who have been able to lift the veil and look within. They have been able to become whole men, pure men. And they have discovered that the true meaning of the word human is what we ordinarily call the perfected Holy One. He is the true human. Now what happens, amongst other things, when the perfected Holy One has emerged into existence, into manifestation? He is a nexus, a focal point. He is like a lens, a perfect lens which has no dust on it, to allow the inflow and outflow of the energy of the transcendent, which is beyond mind. Practically all philosophies of religion stop at the realm of pure mind. Some have affirmed transcendence. And this transcendence is a reality. We have the first great affirmations of this. Hinted at in the Rig Veda, but explicitly stated in the Upanishads. That from which speech and mind return, not having found. But how could they postulate that unless there was some experiencing by the perfected Holy One, in which transcendence flowed in, because he was unresisting to transcendence, and because he was ungrasping, totally ungrasping, and therefore fearless, this is very important, therefore fearless, that transcendent energy flowed out. He was a center for the shining of the infinite. That is what your great yogi is, actually. In that silence, in that which all the world calls utter inactivity, the supreme action, unknown to mortals, takes place. it would be pointless to inquire, how do you know? Have you any proof? Can you adduce any evidence? I cannot adduce any proof or evidence. It is so. If one has that innermost core of sensitivity within oneself sufficiently developed, sufficiently keen, and if the mind can remain quiet, this ordinary mind, which is composed of the collection of the sense consciousnesses and the sense functionings, if that can be quiet, then this sensitivity will leave and impress upon the entire psychophysical organism, because of which the only words you will use are words like infinity, absolute, transcendence, Brahman, Atma, God, Nirvana, anything you like. Because if you look at those words, it is totally impossible to give a dictionary meaning which is either adequate or even reasonably true. Nevertheless, the words are used, and they can be used fearlessly, calmly, to indicate that there is this transcendence, that its realization is a fact of human experience. Now, human experience not as my experience or your experience. When the sense consciousnesses are quiet and the stalking mind has entered its Sabbath, its rest, then there is no separative, isolating self-consciousness. The isolating self-consciousness is out. And when the isolating self-consciousness is out, this purified mind has become so sensitive that it is open to the totality of the experience of all life on this planet. The Buddha has said, hasn't he? And I know with my mind, the mind of this person, that it is thus or thus, of this person, that it is thus or thus, etc. It's very significant. The Buddha was the only one of the great teachers who refused to talk about transcendence. Or if he did, personally, I wouldn't be surprised if he did. If he did, it has never come down as the written word. Nirvana as the transcendent is not quite what is meant by transcendence in the other great religions, particularly in the Upanishadic presentation. There are very good reasons for that. We needn't go into them. I mean, they're matters of interest to the scholar, to the person who wants to know. We are concerned with the practical aspect of things. Now, let us come back to this point. Man, when he is truly man, when I, the subhuman, have grown out of my subhumanity and have become purified and am the true man, I am the nexus, the focal point for the unimpeded inflow and outflow of the energy of the transcendent. People often ask, what is the purpose of our existence? Think upon this, if you like. And see it not as something to be achieved, to be gained, to be attained. Something which is a specific service of the Lord, to use a theistic phrase. But see it as the natural process. Not only of the natural order of the universe, but the natural process of mind only, pure mind, and the natural process of transcendence itself. If you can sense this and really get it, you will get a much deeper insight into a phrase which I have used in the past, quite recently, in the recent past. Transcendence, heaven and earth, or transcendence, pure mind, and the natural order of the universe are all in timeless conjugation. In an eternally creative condition, interplay. Now you see, to what it is that one can give one's whole being. And to Caesar the penny, and to God see the marvel of it, the utter peace and the beauty of it, and the crux of the whole matter is that there is not a vestige of grasping at self left. When the whole of grasping at self and all that is implied in that term, in those terms, when all grasping at self is gone, then this transfiguration of the total being has taken place and remains permanent. This is the living of the holy life, not merely talking about it. This is the religious consciousness in actual fulfillment, the awakened religious consciousness which permeates everything that happens to the man, the living psychophysical person in the natural order of things, the world as it is. What does this imply? It implies something which, if we understand it, will give us true meanings of two important teachings which, generally speaking, have never been adequately understood. Renunciation and relinquishment. Let's consider relinquishment first. When one sees that this, that, or the other is unessential for this religious living, the becoming the nexus, the untarnished nexus for the inflow and outflow of transcendence. When one sees that this, that, and the other is unnecessary for this, then it naturally drops off. If it doesn't naturally drop off, it means that I am ambitious to attain this status of nexus. And that is evil. Meditate very deeply on this. Because if you become really at home with this and see the reality, the truth of it, then selfness will vanish by itself. If something which is an obstruction to transcendence doesn't vanish by itself, then it means that I am in the state of conflict. It means I am an unreliable machine for transcendence to use. So you see the implications of looking within. And this looking within, this kind of looking within, which opens your eyes in this manner, is the profound meaning of mindfulness. The looking within, which is not marred by internal conflict, that is mindfulness. And so, when one really sees that this, that, or the other is not necessary for the flowering out into the perfect Holy One, then you just relinquish it. You just don't grasp it anymore. I'll put it in the other form, which is a most valuable form. This is where Buddhism has made a wonderful contribution. The way it has presented the understanding of the psyche and the mental processes. It's the most superb psychological insight. Relinquishment. And then look at renunciation. What is renunciation then? It is an activity of pure happiness. You are free. You are out of prison when all these things drop off. When I walk out of prison, I should thank my jailer. Not be nasty to him. Because this is wonderful freedom, renunciation. When this dark cloud of selfness which obscures the vision of reality is dispersed, then it is not just my vision of reality which is working through this living person, but it is the total vision. In the religious context, and in terms of the religious consciousness, everything is universal. Nothing is particular. The tragic, agonizing isolation of the particular from the totality is over. And once more, the particular is an integral, living part and parcel of that totality. And that is joy. In that sense, you are you. The unisolated you. And so, relinquishment and renunciation are involved in this. We have already mentioned mindfulness. Now, look back on our considerations of the last meeting. Remember, we talked about right preparation and right approach to religious living. Mindfulness and morality are the indispensable bases for any religious living. Now today we are stressing, we are emphasizing this question of relinquishment. Look at the actual fact which prevails in our own lives. There are thousands of people, as you know very well, sincere, good-hearted, well-intentioned, who want to live the religious life, who study the philosophies of the religions and the teachings, who join groups and societies and go through certain practices and all the rest of it. Have they truly relinquished all that obstructs the pure light of reality? This relinquishment is most intimately tied up with the moralities. And they are very simple. You yourself know from within yourself whether a morality is being observed or not. No other person can impose a morality on one. We are conditioned from childhood in certain moralities. We must not kill, we must not steal, etc. We must not tell lies, and so forth and so forth. All right. How much is there in me from my childhood onwards which is resisting this imposed morality, delighting when I can get away with it? This is due to the act of imposition. Somebody else may not impose it on me. I may impose it on myself. Because my particular type of egoism and vanity functions this way. I want to become the saint. I want to be the server of the Lord, carry the gospel, save the heathen, all the rest of it. You see? So I may impose it on myself. Or I may have such a strong sense of wealth, such a powerful amour propre that, oh, I should never dream of doing such a thing. I demean myself in my own eyes. I have an image which I worship myself in perfection. But all that defeats truth. or I relinquish and renounce to salve my conscience. Endow a hospital with £2 million, a university with £5 million, £10 million for cancer research, etc. We must look into these things. We must be mindful of them inwardly. Mindful in the pure way. Not because we want to obtain a desirable result. But mindful because we have got to that stage where we cannot help but live thus. Just as we cannot help but breathe as we live, as the body lives, we cannot help the heart from beating and fulfilling its function, from the blood from streaming and so forth, when it is as natural and as simple and as joyous as that, then it is true mindfulness. And then this way, this straight and narrow way, with its sharp flints which cut one's feet all along, suddenly becomes the whole, the pure, the happy, trackless way. The flight of the alone to the alone, which is indescribable bliss. And that is a fact, a simple fact. It is indescribable bliss. Now, just let's look into this matter of relinquishment and the first sila which occurs in most religions. Not in all, but in most. In the commandments as laid down in Exodus, for instance, the very first is about the Lord. The first five, in fact, are about the Lord, not making graven images and all the rest of it. And number six starts with thou shalt not kill. But in Hinduism and in Buddhism, those two particularly, the first great sila is harmlessness. To abstain from all harming. All harming. In thought and feeling, in word and in act. So now, let's spend a little time just looking deeply into this. Let the body be perfectly at ease. And the state of ease is the unresisting state, the unconflicting state. Just the healthy elasticity of the living body. And let the rhythm of the breath flow easily. Just your own natural rhythm, very quiet and gentle. Not a question of deep breathing. And with the stillness of the body and the rhythm of the breath, which is one's own life rhythm, let there be also the quietness of the mind. Don't strain to look. Just look with attention, as intense an attention as is naturally, easily possible. And let us see whether we grasp at this, that, or the other. Material possessions first. We could, of course, relinquish that 25-year-old radio set, which is not very good anyway. We could give it away or sell it for 5 shillings. Could let that go and experience no internal conflict about it. But can I let go my beautiful Steinway piano? Or my Ming vase? Or my Titian which I possess? Can I now? Just look. Or to turn to the commoner garden. Can I relinquish this particular fountain pen which I have used for so many years and it's such a dear little thing? Or my back collar stud, which I certainly personally have used ever since I was 9 years old. Still with me. Can I relinquish it? It's not so easy as one may imagine. That is to say, if something takes it away, if it's lost, or mislaid, or if somebody else wants it, is in need of it, can I just give it away, and that's the finish of the action? No substrate for rebirth in thought and feeling, as the Buddha would have said. Look. Can I relinquish all those attachments? Likewise, objects which cause an aversion in me, that awful old lawnmower which never works properly, can I relinquish the aversion towards it? Why can't I? Why do I react emotionally towards it? Because the self and the grasping by the self for the desirable is the obstructive power. Now let us look into that sort of thing very carefully. Grasping by the self. It is rooted in the grasping of self by self. This self-consciousness which isolates. Where there is isolation, there is inevitably fear, the passion to dominate, cruelty, everything which is evil. Look at the other side of the coin. There are all these material objects. Towards which I have a relationship. The objects for use. They may be objects for decoration, for beautifying the home or the garden or whatever it is. Without attachment, without aversion. See, let me see their utility as utility. The mind remaining free of all bondage. So that the Ming vase still graces the drawing room, and so on. But there is nothing which grasps at it. Nothing which pampers vanity, pride, egoism. This is difficult, very difficult. But if there is right relationship, free of grasping, then there is perfect use. There is reverent use of material objects. And if there is perfect and reverent use of matter, then one is harmless in relation to matter. Therefore, the one, say an artist, handles his material with great skill, with perfection. He handles it harmlessly, with right relationship towards it. That is an expression of religious living. And the same would apply to the simplest things of everyday life. When one dresses oneself, when one cleans the room, makes it tidy, orderly, beautiful, tends the garden, cooks the meal, all that done rightly means harmlessness. But we have to be mindful, we have to be awake to it from moment to moment. It is this mindfulness which is the strenuous part of religious living. Unmindfulness, forgetfulness is laxity, flabbiness of spirit. Turn to something else. Our status in life. I have this, that, or the other as a status symbol. Or this, that, or the other responsible post which shows my status. Or my bank balance which shows my status in relation to my neighbor or whatever it is. How do I view all that? If I see it with right wisdom, to use the Buddha's phrase, and see it as relative, as impermanent, see it for what it really is, and there is no grasping at it. If I enjoy a certain status in life, that means that I am responsible for that particular position, then that responsibility is dispassionately, unpossessively fulfilled to the best of my ability, and that is the complete end of it. And in that is fulfillment. Status. My status as a parent, as a brother, as a friend, we must look into this in order to realize freedom from all grasping. That is the point. It doesn't mean that I must walk out of my house and go and live inside a cave or something. I might only make myself a burden, a liability upon the government or upon society. We should be just folly, not religious living. It's the grasping. If one is free from grasping, then when it disappears out of one's life, out of one's immediate situation, there is no pain, there is no sorrow, there is no waste of energy upon it at all. Similarly, can I relinquish all the demands that I make, the psychological demands, my wife upon my wife, my husband, my child, my friend, my employee, my employer? Can I relinquish all that nonsense? Because if I can, then there is every chance of being the good or the perfect parent, friend, etc. Otherwise not. Can I relinquish my beliefs, my convictions, my theories? All the teachings to which I cling, fully believing they are absolute truth. Because we must remember, every belief, conviction, teaching, whatsoever is formulated is the containing vessel. It is the symbol. It is only an appearance which could have useful and right significance, but itself is not the ultimate realm. Only the liberated religious consciousness, which is no longer self-enclosing, but has become universal, that alone, if we may use this particular word, knows the ultimate real. And it knows by being it, and not by looking at it, not through having acquired it. Therefore, can I relinquish all that I have garnered through the decades? You see what relinquishment means. If I relinquish, but look at the result, if I relinquish these barriers to reality, then all selfness has been renounced. And what has happened? There is only truth. The fact. There is only pure wisdom and pure love. We must look very deeply as we meditate, particularly when we are by ourselves. Look very deeply into all the implications as well as the essential significance of this simple word, relinquishment. And when this sort of thing is there, there is proper relinquishment and proper renunciation, then one has become harmless. Remember the tremendous importance of harmlessness. Again and again we can repeat the Buddha's words, "He who lives without hurting himself, without hurting others, lives with a self, become Brahman, the ultimate reality." Lives with a self, become Brahman. The importance of harmlessness. Not to kill is just the most dramatic expression of it. It's easy enough for all of us not to kill a person. Not even to be an accessory to the killing of a person. But killing has innumerable forms, hasn't it? It's so interesting to see how the Buddha says that he abstains from all harming, from all onslaught on creatures and on plants even. Any creature, every creature. It's in the Brahmajala Sutta, in black and white, you can see for yourselves. Completely abstains from all harming. But I could kill with a look, couldn't I? I don't mean kill the person bodily, but shrivel up the heart in another. By an unkind, ungracious look. Or by omitting to give the friendly look that someone needs at the moment, hungers for. Recall the effect upon children. When the elders are so self-occupied that the poor child is starved for just that little sign of divinity which can come only from its parent. I can kill by a word, can't I? If I use the wrong word. The wound that will never heal. And it is literally never healed for most people. One meets sometimes with people who remember a word which was spoken to them, a phrase, a sentence, which cut to the quick when they were very little children, and through their lives it is remembered with sorrow and with pain. Harmlessness. And this not only in relation to others, but in relation to oneself too. He who lives not hurting oneself, not hurting others, lives with a self become Brahman. Think how we harm even Mother Earth itself. Our terrible depredations upon this planet. And we are subhuman enough to call it progress. Harmlessness towards everything. Harmlessness to the atmosphere. I'm not talking of just the physical air. How often, how constantly I strut upon the world stage, asserting my ego, my importance, making a noise in the world, a loud character. How often do I burst out into a cacophonous laugh? If I do so in a room, do the walls hear and shrink? If I do that in a garden, does the grass, do the flowers hear and shrivel? Maybe they do very slightly, we don't know. But if one is intensely mindful and is really awake to all this, then the innermost deep spring of pure compassion has a chance of welling out, because there is nothing to obstruct that spring now. Harmlessness. And with such harmlessness comes fearlessness. A quietness. Not merely an external quietness, but an inward peace. The person I live with, the person I work with, or persons as the case may be, the persons I meet and so forth, they are so noisy, they are so intolerant, etc. Do I react back in my mind and harm them? When I hear dreadful news of evil things done, does my heart and mind flare out in indignation, in vengeful anger against the evildoer? If I am really mindful, and this is a terribly strenuous task, very, very strenuous and difficult, if I am truly mindful, I shall be at peace. Not indifferent, not unaffected. I shall be at peace, intensely sensitive. But because of my harmlessness, that evil can be absorbed in my own psyche and purified because of the flow of pure compassion. So I do not charge the atmosphere, the psychical atmosphere, with more evil, with more hate and resentment and horror. Harmlessness. We must look into all this within ourselves. And bear in mind that this is just the beginning of morality. Simple, pure morality. And if we understand this, we will understand also why the Buddhist Jataka stories came into being. They are not at all factual statements about incarnations of Siddhartha Gautama as an animal and as a human and all the rest of it. They are wonderfully woven, true to the underlying spirit of the whole thing. In order that man may learn, mythology is one of the most wonderful ways of understanding the mind and the heart of man, particularly the heart of man. And so, as we look within ourselves, for our own selves, and see the reality of harmlessness, the truth of harmlessness, it becomes an operative thing in our daily life. Not by somebody else telling me or you, do this, do the other, avoid this, avoid the other. All right, let's stop a few moments. Let us go on. In order to let this flower of harmlessness grow, and this applies to any of the immoralities, any of the virtues and so forth, we must look very carefully, very clearly, into our fantasies, into our dreams, and above all, into our memories. Take one or two of the commonest afflictions of all mankind. When we are young, we fall in love, as we call it. We fall in love because we are immature. The mature one is always all love. There is no falling in or jumping out of love for the mature one. The pure human. But for me, the subhuman, right from childhood onwards, I fall in love. With my mother and or father, with some brother or sister, and particularly with my school friend, or some master or mistress or whoever it is who is very kind or attractive or nice and so forth. And as I grow to adolescence, I fall in love with the opposite sex, people of the opposite sex, and fall out. Only extremely rarely does the boy-girl falling in love be the one and only thing for the rest of their days together. Extremely rarely. But most of us undergo pain. Some of us undergo dreadful suffering because of it. Dreadful suffering. And it becomes a scar upon the mind and the heart, an ineradicable memory. And this ineradicable memory thrust deep down into the hidden recesses of the mind lives as a source of terrible evil in us, which bursts out under various circumstances in innumerable horrible, hurtful, harmful ways, harmful to myself, harmful to others. Again and again, this demon inside me has vengeance upon me upon others, upon my whole situation. Often I'm aware that it is that memory. He treated me thus, she jilted me thus, and I was so sincere and believed and absolutely shattered everything inside me. Now, we keep these memories, or we try to suppress them, or we bring intellectual arguments against them. In other words, everything that out of ignorance, unhappy ignorance that we do, everything increases the bondage and the pain and the misery. I'm taking just one example which is fairly common to humanity. There are so many other spheres, not merely falling in love, but so many other spheres. Frustrated ambition, injustice in some way or other. The prize in the class should have been given to me because I saw that fellow cribbing at the exam and he came first by just 2 marks more than me and so forth. And somehow that remains as a peculiarly piercing memory. Something like that. Although there are hundreds of things like that which could happen. And they are forces for destruction. These are the demonic forces, the asuric forces which operate in our life. So we get distorted and we become people who will be far more insistent than others for justice. And we shall be cruel in order that justice may be carried out. That means my picture of what ought to be has to be carried out. Now you see, we must look into these memories. It's no good just letting them lie. Consider the extraordinary wisdom of the Greeks. They put it in this symbolic form. After death, the soul will approach two streams. One is Lethe, the river of forgetfulness. The other is the river of memory. Take the path which leads to the river of memory and not of forgetfulness. What is forgotten is the incompleted thing, the substrate for rebirth, as it is called. The rebirth which goes on in your own consciousness, in your own mind. I'm not referring to any reincarnational idea at all, but this thing which goes on in the mind. How easily we say, oh, forget it all. For goodness sake, don't remind me of it. I don't want to think about it. That is precisely what we mustn't do. Because if I do that, and we all do it, if I do that, it will be impossible for me to become harmless. I shall inevitably be harmful. You see, if I remember and am mindful of it in the right way, then it dissolves that psychical tumor and makes it good psychical, healthy psychical tissue instead of being a tumor. I don't cut it out, gouge it out. That is the wrong way. Besides, you can't do it with the psyche. You can fool yourself, you do it, but you can't. You can perform an operation on the physical body. You can't perform it on the psyche like that. You see, you convert it into healthy psychical tissue. And in that conversion, in that transformation, the entire situation of that past is completely healed. There is forgiveness in the grand sense, in the pure sense. And then one understands that I, the separate, isolated, self-conscious individual, can never forgive. God alone forgives. And God is the totality, not somebody here or there. That totality forgives. What is the meaning of that forgiving? Because of the forbearing which has taken place continuously, the waiting in patience. And then at last, through this mindfulness, the light of truth comes out. And lo and behold, forgiveness in the grand sense has taken place. A healing. The healing, which is so important. When that healing takes place, that kind of healing goes on taking place, this which I call my mind is getting into perfect harmony with pure mind, with the all mind. Because this which I call my mind is getting emptied of all grasping, of all restricting, of all clouding and spoiling. It is becoming utterly transparent. You know, consider very deeply the Buddha's teachings. With right wisdom, do not grasp at Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara, Vijnana. Do not grasp. A free inflow and outflow. This is of utmost importance. Be mindful. So now, one gets into harmony with that. And when one is in harmony with that, then one will know personally, through one's own experiencing the meaning of that word akasha. You know, in the summer school talks of the last 3 or 4 years, I've spoken about akasha bit by bit. But quite simply and clearly, akasha means mind space. Try and be free of the connotations, the denotation as well as the connotations of the word space, particularly space. This is what hinders us from knowing it. For us, space is our physical experience of space. And for us, space is a container. And it is vast in size. It is huge in size. We say it is infinite in size. And so forth. It is dimensional. It is measurable. Actually, we don't measure space. We only measure the distance between two limited, finite particulars, two objects. Space always remains the mystery. It's like a sort of a game in which space says, "Come on, catch me." And you go racing all over space. And you can't catch it. Now this akasha, mind space, has no dimensions, no distances. It is not measurable. Not measurableness is something which the intellect cannot grasp. It completely defeats the intellect. When the mind, the brain mind, if I may hyphenate the two words, when the brain mind has become quiet, this mysterious sensitivity within the living organism, which is pure mind, is freed and it is at one with that mystery, which is the immeasurable mind space. Now this mind space is constantly fecundated by transcendence. I think there are one or two vague hints in some of the old writings, but apart from hints, I don't think that anything specific has been written about it. But this energy of transcendence fecundates that mind space. This mysterious thing with no dimensions at all, not even a container. It fecundates it, and all the archetypal forms and forces are contained there. Somehow that comes through into the natural universe through what we call space and into the brain and affects it. There is a link. In fact, there is only one total reality all the time. But consciousness functioning through this creature that nature has made, man, with a brain, is limited and unable to be aware of this totality. But it is the purification here which opens the door. Now, of course, this is a purely physical simile. It opens the door, and you become aware of that. Aware without any shape or form or quality. This is the important thing. The shape and form and quality has been given throughout the religious teachings of the world in terms of what they call their angelic orders and the demonic orders and so forth. The impress of this archetypal force comes through into the man who has become quiet, and then he has absolutely no option but to interpret that in terms of his visual, auditory, tactile and other consciousnesses and give shape and form and substance. So the archangels and the angels and the Amishaspans and the Suras and the Asuras and the whole host of them come up. But they are not mere fantasies of an imaginative human mind. They are extremely suggestive, significant pictures. They are helpful pictures, if one knows how to use them. See, no less than a Buddha, no less than a Jesus, easily and freely spoke of devas and of angels and the great prophets of the Old Testament. Zarathustra spoke freely of them. Why did they speak in this manner? They were not subhumans. They had purified minds. And the Buddha said of himself, a being not liable to delusion has arisen in the world. He definitely said so of himself. All right. He spoke about these things. And he says, it's in the second volume of the Majjhima Nikaya, right at the very end of the last discourse, practically the last page, Sangharava, yes, of course there are devas. Nobody ever disputes about it. It's a fact. And so forth. Very good. Now, in our day and age, it's no good us sort of keeping to the pictures of the old world, of the old age. We must see into the significance of these things. And I'm trying to suggest to you something of the nature of this significance. That when the mind has become purified, when you have become harmless, when there is proper relinquishment and renunciation, and there is this entering into your own inner sanctum, this Sabbath of the senses and the talking brain, then that sensitivity which is pure mind attached to the living organism is at one with this akasha, and the impress of that comes through. And in our day and age, it will come through as springs of action, springs for behavior. And behavior not only outwardly, physically, with the body, but this inward behavior of the intelligence within, which will see this underlying formless, shapeless truth of things, and be able to disentangle it from the forms and shapes which that truth takes. Now this is very, very important. When you get such a person, then he is not liable to delusion. And it is such a person who becomes the nexus for transcendence. I should like, if you can bear with me a little longer, to read one or two little things from the Prajnaparamita. Bodhisattva, perfect wisdom, form, etc. are mere words. They are not, do not arise, are false to behold. Be very careful. Don't never attempt to grasp holy wisdom. Just let the mind be quiet. I think it is quite safe to shock you, but, and I know you won't be shocked. In the ultimate sense, there is neither karma nor karma result. Sariputra asks, of what is the term Buddha a synonym? Manjushri answers, of what then is the term self a synonym? Sariputta asks, of what is the term Buddha a synonym? Manjushri answers, of what is the term self a synonym? Sariputra, non-production is a synonym for self. Manjushri, so it is, Sariputra. And that of which self is a synonym, of that also Buddha is a synonym. Or the trackless is another word for Buddha. For a Buddha cannot easily be intimated by words. One who wants, Sariputra, to seek for the Tathagata should seek for the self. For self and Buddha are synonymous. Just as the self absolutely does not exist and cannot be apprehended, just so the Buddha. As the self cannot be expressed by any dharma, Dharma in the Prajnaparamita, in Mahayana teaching, essentially means, an event of sensory or mental experience. That is the meaning of the word dharma. An event of sensory or mental experience. As the self cannot be expressed by any dharma, so also the Buddha. The Buddha is the same as speechless silence.